Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, and especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you, smoke anyway. It gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
Stuff like that.
Sure.
God, you cut that off.
Sorry.
Like the classic. Yeah, the classic like soundboard like drops. Because I used to listen to a bunch of radio, like kind of. I guess back when drops were always like a big like shock radio thing. But like I listened to like a radio show that like very specifically like started getting more shock jockey, and they just started like very clearly the producers were like, we need more drops, we need more like, you know, funny out of context. It was always like out of context stuff that the host would say. But yeah, like the also laser beams, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I kind of miss that era of radio a little bit, to be quite honest. There's something that in my monkey brain that is activated by...
The most like, Aaron Grossman take I've ever heard. It's just like, I kind of miss insert objectively terrible thing.
I don't think it's good, but it is kind of, it is funny in a way.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I don't know.
It tickles a very specific nostalgia, I think that, like, perhaps.
I think that era of shock jock radio is so, like, it's forever associated with, like, racism. And sexism.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
Like, every single one of the drops is like an offensive joke, which makes it harder to enjoy for
homophobic,
me. But
like,
yeah,
completely.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's just, right. Which kind of weirdly appropriate for the movie we're discussing today in some ways.
Some stuff in there.
I think maybe I adjusted the gain. Is it better?
It is better.
A little bit, yeah.
It sounds better.
Sounds good. Okay, I don't know if I did, but I think I did.
Wow.
In device settings on Windows.
Are you a wizard?
Yeah, he had to go into the fucking settings and everything.
I was written into the book. It's after the books. J.K. Rowling was like, we need a Jewish one or whatever. Whatever the joke is. I don't know.
I think there's an inspirational quote poster with that saying, like in soft italics, like we needed a Jewish one or whatever.
Or whatever.
You could just pick any minority that you're a part of, and the joke would be equally hilarious because
represented. The Jewish thing like actually happened. Like someone someone on Twitter was like, how come there's no Jewish people and they're like Anthony, and she literally was. I forget her reply, but it's like Anthony Goldstein, third.
I think it was literally Goldstein.
Oh, it was literally Goldstein.
What do you mean? I have a good memory for this. It's literally Anthony Goldstein. I didn't pick it up. Anthony Goldstein.
Yeah, everybody was like, oh wow, he's my second favorite after the Irish character Lucky McCarbombs.
Representation matters, folks. Thank you for listening to Try Love. This is a literal roundtable podcast where we talk about the movies we saw and the people we met / the people we already knew at the Try Love Cinema in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can find us on Twitter at Try Love Podcast. And more importantly, you can find the Trylon at Trylon Cinema and at Trylon.org. Go there. Check out all the great stuff they've got lined up for the next few months. Our usual MC, Jason Daphnis, is once again out on assignment. But you know what? His furniture is as fake as my orgasms. I'm Cody Narveson, and you can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narveson.
Fade in. The year is 2024. The question on everyone's lips, what is Soylent Green? I'm Harry Mack, and you can find me on Twitter at PunishTake.
My name is Aaron. It is my policy as a podcaster to remain a true observer and not interfere with my subjects. Sorry, Cody, if you were going to use that at the end. You can find me on Twitter at RBPlease.
Spoilers, I was not. Great polls all around. Another great poll for this episode is special guest Drew Tenenbaum. Welcome, Drew. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks. I hope when you edit this podcast, you just have me laughing uncontrollably off screen. For an uncomfortably long period of time.
We'll get one laugh that will be on the mic, and then we'll edit it back in every time. Yeah. It's wild that this is your first time on this podcast, by the way.
I've been a long time listener to sporadic episodes, maybe one every 50 episodes.
Sure.
Hell yeah.
But that's like a good, like seven episodes now.
Yeah. That's quite a few episodes.
Am I close? But I'm happy to finally be on.
Yeah, we are lucky to finally have you. We will get into why you're here for this specific movie in just a moment. But first, we need to know which movie we're actually talking about. And with Aaron's help, I think we will get there. Aaron?
Yes, indeed, folks. Oh, thanks. We are talking about Drop Dead Gorgeous, 1999 film directed by Michael Patrick Jan. The film is a mockumentary. It follows a high school student, Amber Atkins, played by Kirsten Dunst, as she competes in the annual Sarah Rose Cosmetics American Teen Princess Pageant in her small town of Mount Rose, Minnesota. Atkins hopes to win the pageant so that she can get a scholarship for college and also to kind of follow and become a famous broadcast journalist like Diane Sawyer. The film shows the events leading up to the pageant as well as the pageant itself, which kind of turns out to be a largely corrupt affair. We'll get into it. The film has a pretty fucking stacked cast, I would say. Not just Kirsten, but Denise Richards is in this. Kirstie Alley, Brittany Murphy, Amy Adams in a small part. Will Sasso, Adam West in a cameo. Kind of who's who of just like random people popping up throughout this entire
Allison
film.
Allison Janney, who famously yes. once said that this is the movie she gets like...
I know.
Like the talked most, about the like most
people yeah. just coming up and just like she also has a very good role in this. So like,
yeah, she's great in it. You know, it's just hilarious memorable. That this is the one.
Yes. The film was a bit, unfortunately, a bit of a failure on release by most metrics, received kind of mixed reviews. It didn't really make back its budget. Over the years, though, it's become kind of understood as a cult classic film. This was my first time seeing this. Another important aspect, especially just because fucking Jason's not on the podcast. This is a very Minnesota fucking movie. I believe we're all Minnesota people. Yes, we're all. So the very Minnesota movie. I'm sure we'll get into it. Drew, it's my understanding you like this movie. This is, I don't know what your kind of history with it is. I don't know. Do you mind if I pass it over to you and kind of give us what's your history with the movie? What was it like watching it this time? Did you grow up with it? Do you know it? Love it? All that kind of stuff.
I definitely didn't grow up with the movie. When I joined Minneapolis improv company called Comedy Sports, the creative director, Doug Nethercott, recommended this film specifically to me after we watched Waiting for Guffman, which is about, you know, another mockumentary film about local theater, which is, you know, similar to pageantry. And he's like, you're going to love this film as well. So I watched it, and I remember crying, laughing when we see the performance by Becky Lehman, which, of course, I'm sure we'll cover in more detail later. But like, that was one of the funniest things I had seen in a movie in a long time. I remember maybe like a year and a half ago, I don't know, Harry and I like watched like 25 minutes of it, but then it was a snow emergency, which is a classic Minnesota, Minneapolis thing to happen while watching that movie. And then, like, it was just, like, late. I had to go move my car, and I was like, we'll just watch this another time. And then we never did until now, at which we watched it at separate points in time. No, but since the first time I watched it, that was maybe in 2015, back when I was recommended it, I've probably watched it maybe, like, once a year. Like, it just feels very nostalgic. Like, it almost, watching that opening of the film this time almost kind of hurt a little bit. I don't know if that resonates with anyone else, but like, I think as a Minnesotan, I get, and we all might get a little bit more out of seeing those like scenes from our memories, right? Like scenes of kids squirting squirt guns at each other in the summer, like scenes of high school, scenes of suburban streets, like that stuff goes so hard in my memory. Like we live that, and this movie captures that so well.
Yes, I have to agree. I was not aware of this film.
This is so fucking funny to me. Oh my God, I cannot wait to hear you talk about this, Aaron. Sorry, go ahead.
I was not aware what this movie was. I sit down to watch this movie for recording, and like 30 seconds in, I'm just like, oh no, oh God, no. I grew up, so well, not to just make this big fucking Minnesota circle jerk.
But this
like,
is what it's. This is what up, it's for, dude. Let's do
I
it.
Mean, this is what it, this is what it is. We gotta push through this. I grew up in St. Cloud, Minnesota, which is not like small town, but it is, you know, a small town in Minnesota, mostly kind of known for a bunch of racial violence, unfortunately, probably more than anything else. I lived around a bunch of communities that are just like this. I guess the number one for me would be Luxembourg, which is maybe 20 minutes outside of St. Cloud, that was like the German, you know, like small religious town. And it like, yeah, I just like, you know, I was never doing beauty pageants, of course, but I did like marching band, and like so much of like this movie and its like very unique Minnesotan-ness is like really just like sent me back in a very weird way. I think that like I can't speak to like other areas of the United States and like how they're represented in film, but I found this to be, to my understanding, like the most like specifically accurate like satire of like a region that's like not like New York or like LA or something like that, that like that I've seen in a film. It was absurd watching this thing. The shot of the outside of the VFW and it's advertising,
dude,
like a pancake,
oh my
breakfast,
God,
and a meat raffle. I was like, holy shit, I've been to so many VFWs having meat raffles and pull tabs and like, oh my God. Like, I know that's not like unique to Minnesota, but like, yeah, this movie is like so accurate at all that stuff. And it's like, it's also doing all this other good stuff we'll talk about, but like every minute someone would say something or there'd be a reference to like, you know, just Minnesota-ness that would like cause me like a lot of pain, to be quite honest. It's a great experience watching this movie. I was delighted and quite surprised with it, I guess. Harry, what's your, you got anything similar?
No,
this?
Yeah, I think the one that really got to me, there were two, and there are so many that I guess we could just like really like go through our favorite Minnesota-isms. The lutefisk obviously is a great one. The one that weirdly got to me the most was when they're first introducing Rosemount and they've got the world's oldest Lutheran on the,
I was going to bring this up. This was going to be mine. Yes, the world's oldest Lutheran. I was like, too real. That's
already too real and an incredible joke. I feel like growing up in Minnesota, like I've heard so many jokes specifically about like Lutherans and how Lutherans differ from us other Christian denominations and why they're better, et cetera, et cetera. But like, and then specifically the fact that that scene transitions to this farmer explaining the sign and he keeps calling, he's like, first of all, she's dead. I keep asking the Shriners to take down the goddamn sign, but those lazy sons of bitches won't do it. And I was just like, for some reason, like somebody on this movie must have like been from one of these regions, right? Because like specifically like naming the Shriners and like having a conservative white dude who like swears very casually all the time that way is so funny to me and so specific. So that one really got me. And then I think Tammy Baldwin, who only has one scene in the movie, she's like the jock that gets killed first, spoilers, her accent work and her personality are also like so incredibly on point for a very specific type of woman that I have known
many we know those
of.
People
yes
I know five of those people yes
right. And like I've worked with them, I've worked for them, I went to school with them, and like it is like wild that like it, especially like I think Charlie pointed this out, that like this movie came out in 99, 3 years after Fargo. This was sort of like the beginning of a new micro genre, right? Of like specifically making fun of Minnesota, I guess, kind of, or like the upper Midwest. And I think that this movie is like, people talk about how like Fargo is not really actually accurate at all to the Minnesota experience. I think that's probably decent. I wouldn't call that a criticism. I think it's just true. But like this movie is like way better at that, I think, right? I think it's just because like with Waiting for Guffman, when you can do the sort of like absurdist through the looking glass, like micro community of something like a pageant in this case or community theater in that case, like something about like what they're getting wrong only like it accentuates what they get right, or something about the strange specificity of it also makes the broadness feel more appropriate. Or maybe it's the fact that they're high school students or what, but yeah, I don't know. I think that like it's really funny to talk about this with fellow Minnesotans. I'm so glad. And I feel like that's at least a part of its cult appeal, because I noticed that every single showing of this movie, I believe, sold out well in advance at the Trilon, which is very unusual for the Trilon. And I wonder if like other, not that there really are other micro cinemas in the country, but like, I wonder if it would be that popular elsewhere, or if this is like distinctly a Minnesotan thing. I could see either way, right? Because like, I think that this movie is like
a really fantastic example of specifically a cult movie, like you had said, Aaron, and I can't really wait to talk about what I mean by that. But even more specifically, just like, what a wild ride to watch as Minnesotans, I guess. What do you think, Cody? What's your history with this movie?
Yeah, everybody's characterized this incredibly well so far. And I'm like, I want to approach this tactfully because there are so many different threads we could go down and that eventually inevitably devolve into us just like talking about our favorite bits, which, hell, that might just be the episode. That's totally okay too. I had seen this once, this is my third time watching it. I just kind of sought it out towards the start of the pandemic once it, and we were kind of talking a little more intensely before hopping on mic, or before our mics went hot, rather, that this movie is difficult to watch. It has its fluctuations where it's like sometimes rentable or streamable, and then most of the time it's not. There was a Blu-ray release put out. I think I caught it during like when it was available for streaming, and then the Blu-ray came out shortly thereafter, and I was like, I gotta have this for a lot of reasons. Number one being that I enjoyed it and could see myself watching it again. I think my dad and I watched it, sometime within the last year or two, because he had heard about it and like thought it was great. And I was like, I got the Blu-ray, shit, let's watch it. And then I watched it, for my third time sometime last week. I did not make one of the try-on screenings. I'm sure the environment there would have been bonkers, fabulous. I don't know if anybody listening to this can attest to that. It seems like a really great environment to watch this movie specifically in. And yeah, I mean, for all the reasons that y'all had, that's like the detailing the sort of fight or flight sort of impulse while watching this movie. The characterizing, you can kind of see them between the lines, being referencing Minneapolis, St. Paul as this effectively this like liberal wasteland. They've got it made here. Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Even like talking about things that are and aren't necessarily intrinsically Minnesotan, but like when they were. Like it started the third ish act when like everybody's on lawn chairs, like waiting for a parade to go through. That's like me growing up in Rochester. Like we had a Rochester Fest parade every year. And like, that's the whole city looked like that. Everybody just like decked out with their wonky hardware store coolers filled with soda and just like, you know, lawn chairs that have been passed down from Minnesota generation to Minnesota generation. The detail work in this, like the, you know, whatever research was put it, like they nailed so many of these things. The thing when I've been talking to non us friends about this movie and just being like, hey, seek this out if you can. The one of the kind of intro gags that I use to characterize the specific satirical nature of this is, I think it's Kirstie Alley's character having that meeting at the start and being like, okay, well, you know, that's everything. Go ahead and treat yourself to some coffee and bars, which bars, is like bars. Yep. Super just like, I know that's not the funniest gag, but that is just like, as far as setting the table for, yeah, I mean, it's fucking bars and hot dish up here. It's like they know that. And they know that there is a very specific way to handle invoking Fargo and invoking Christopher Guest. Those are two inevitable, I think, comps and totally appropriate comps for this, but like going maybe in a softer direction with these accents, less over the top, maybe. It's been a little while, or like a couple years since I've gone back to Fargo, so like maybe I'm just seeing this in a certain light, but like Kirsten Dunst, and even like Brittany Murphy, Amy Adams, Kirstie Alley, I think does really great with her accent as well. And it's simultaneously my favorite thing and least favorite thing about this movie, that Denise Richards is just not even trying. It's like the most anti-Minnesotan accent possible. But like all of that is swimming in a pool that, it feels so great to revisit. You know, Drew, citing the like every like once a year sort of cadence, like this movie could very easily occupy that sort of space for me. And it seems like we're all generally kind of on the same page. So I don't know what seems like most fertile as far as like jumping, you know, whether we, you know, want to dig into the cast more, like specific ensemble players that we want to kind of touch on, or if there's anything else specific to like the Minnesotan-ness of this movie that is really kind of calling to you, Harry. What's sticking in your craw right now?
Sure. I guess I have like the question I have about this, and maybe you guys feel differently, which is why I bring it up, is that like I really was taken with the sort of description of this as a cult film. That's kind of what I've been thinking about a lot with this. I just rewatched this with Charlie, and she had the same thought, which is that like I have like a weird pet peeve when somebody just calls like what I think is a legitimate good movie, a cult movie, or like a movie that was just overlooked for whatever reason, but it has come to be sort of critically seen as like really great. For me, like there is something more specific about a cult movie in that like a movie like this like doesn't quite work, right? It's like, it, and especially because of like, it's so of its time. I think there's a lot of humor in it that is very broad and that is also offensive, that is like not even really funny when you get past the offensiveness of it, that like is not, it is only a joke that is there to offend. For instance, the R word is used a shocking number of times in this
over
movie.
Over and over.
Like, yeah, and is often like the entire joke, right? Like the joke is that it's funny that somebody is calling somebody else that. There is nothing like beyond that. In its own way, and like I feel kind of bad about this, so like you can cancel me if you want, like that's kind of part of the charm almost of this movie to me, is that like it is capturing specifically a shitty 1999 humor that like
right.
doesn't really exist anymore and shouldn't exist anymore, but like it is something that like I like the biggest maybe surprise of this movie is that there wasn't more fucking homophobia, I guess, right? Because like that was my big experience as like a kid in the early 2000s, that like, oh, like, yeah, everybody was calling each other the R word. Everybody was like, racial slurs were oddly prominent in my junior high and high school. And like gay humor was like the funniest shit in the world to people.
But this movie didn't sidestep it entirely.
No, very, it very much did not. No, don't you worry about that. Yeah. But like there is something like it that almost elevates this movie, not in a quality wise, but like in terms of like, I think that like in addition to everything else it's doing, something about the offensive and often stupid nature of the humor here kind of weirdly makes this like a time capsule to me. Even more so than it already was, where it's like, and like that in tandem with the fact that like every single like super famous, super successful female performer of the 2000s and 2010s seems to be in this movie in as like one of their first performances. Like specifically, this is Amy Adams' fucking first performance ever, which is insane because it's like, oh, like she's one of her generation's best actresses. Obviously, Kirsten Dunst, Brittany Murphy is fucking amazing in this movie, and like I cry every time she's on screen, basically. Yeah, I don't know. There's just like there's something so almost uncanny about this movie that kind of makes it painful in the way that I would describe to Aaron. Like, this is a bit of a tangent, but like Charlie pointed out that like this movie came out the same year as But I'm a Cheerleader and has kind of had the same reception, where I'm a Cheerleader actually has a lower Rotten Tomatoes score than this movie does, which frankly is fucking crazy to me. Like I think that like objectively But I'm a Cheerleader is like a better movie than this is, but like that's similar, right? In that like those are two movies that were just sort of like kind of ahead of their time, in that they were like depicting a specific period that people didn't realize they were living in at the time or something, and so in hindsight like it becomes so prescient feeling, or it feels like such a great encapsulation of this thing where it's like an accidental period piece or something. I don't know, but how do you guys feel about that? How do you feel about that, Aaron?
I think like one thing that makes this movie maybe work, like kind of touching a little bit on what you were talking about, like what makes this movie work, I think a bit more than what you would expect, is that I think that the kind of focus on like small town Minnesota, or like kind of America in general, kind of in all, you know, so much of the focus of the humor, like being in that direction, I think kind of helps this like sidestep another version of this movie that's like markedly worse. Like, I think if you just like told me what this movie is about, like, I think in my mind, I just think like, okay, it's a bunch of like pedophilia jokes, right? Like, it's like a bunch of jokes around like the nastiness of like teen beauty competitions, right?
And don't worry, there are some of those.
Well, it does have it, but I think like the way it does it is like kind of brilliant, that like Matt Malloy is playing like a character called John Doe, right? Which is clearly like making a joke about kind of, you know, the larger nature of these pageants and the people who are interested in them. But he's like one character, and I think he's like the only one who basically gets those jokes. But it is like so well done for that one character, like that sort of humor. And when that character's not on screen, it like very nicely sidesteps around what I think like probably would threaten to like kind of envelop the whole film in like a weird way. And I don't know, because like that is like obviously a touchy subject. Like, I'm not someone who's super into child beauty pageants, but they seem pretty fucked up to me, just like generally. And I think the way that it like it handles that character is like very funny. I think Matt Malloy is like kind of killing all of those scenes, even from the beginning. Like, I think just like
his
facial
face
mannerisms.
Is so goddamn funny, dude. Like the way
he
holds
so
that character,
clearly, like guilty, just constantly guilty, and like just assuming that everybody watching knows that he is guilty. I think the way that it also plays with the idea of like, and this is like an area that I think a lot of these sorts of films like kind of fuck up, but like the way that this plays with like him constantly being aware that he is on camera and that his like humor is not just a reaction to you know, him obviously like, you know, thirsting after these teenage girls, but also doing so in a position where he is being recorded on video and has to pretend like, oh, I'm not doing anything weird here. Not like the most like deep thing in the world, but like done, I think, like as well as it could be done. And I think like the movie, that's like not just how the movie approaches like that subject, but like most of the humor that's not like, you know, again, like throwing around the R word and whatnot. So like, I don't know. I think that like this movie works more than you might expect in a weird way.
This is sort of about class adversity, right? Like the main character is like depicted as a lower class towards those who are, you know, oppressing her. And that's those who are running the pageant and using the pageant for like their gains socially, politically, right? Like we see that they're using it for at least, you know, small town political gain. You know, they run the furniture shop, but they draw the metaphor even as far as having these characters who are such in control of the pageant killing off characters who are threats to them. And it's commentary on, you know, on class in a more nuanced way than I think people might give it credit for when you really just sort of look at the comedy of the movie, right? Like this is a movie about someone rigging a pageant and someone overcoming that, you know. Yeah, it's a comedy film, but like I don't want to like they could have chosen any content, right? Like they didn't have to have any killings, right? They didn't have to have any murders at all, and like I think the movie would have been almost the same, very similar. But like that's such a big part of the film, right? Like there's countless deaths throughout the film, and it's also the movie is named after that, of course, and that's what they were going for. But like so far, what we've talked about the film could have been a different film without this content. And so like the specific, like how far they take the satire all the way to murder is very, very funny. And also the laissez-faire attitude they have towards it, as far as making Amber, the main character, someone who tap dances around death. Literally, she tap dances while she's prettifying, making death beautiful. It's very there's a lot of stuff to be found here if you really dig. If we can continue to talk about bits because there's so many and I want to do so, but I didn't want to for those people who like to analyze a little bit too deeply. I see some people who want to talk about it rubbing their hands maniacally. There's stuff to talk about.
That's a really good point, Drew. I love that. And I also like, I think one of the big things to respond to both your point and Aaron's is that like, I feel like what this movie does that's really kind of smart is that it seems to know that you know already that child pageants are inherently kind of fucked. And it doesn't spend a lot of time like actually satirizing that in like a dark finger wagging way, right? Like it never lets the sort of idea of that satire override its sense of humor. And that's not even its point, right? Like the point of this movie is not like, hey, isn't it fucked up how weird child pageants are? Like we're way past that, right? Like this is like post satirical satire. It like assumes that you know what it's doing.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like it to the point where like you like from the first frame of this movie, I would say it like argues that you already know that it's parroting satires. And so like that does set the stage for this more interesting thing, right? Where they actually can kind of tap into the psychology of the people running the pageant, which what was so funny to me about that is that like you are right in the sense that like Kirstie Alley's character, Gladys Lehman, the person who's running the pageant, she is like benefiting from it, but like not really, right? Like the reason she's doing this is ultimately, I would argue, like a psychological benefit above anything else, right? It's like her husband is like maybe going to make money off of it. He like financed it, but like, obviously, this is just a way for her to sort of like endlessly relitigate her own past and come out on top.
Yeah, it's for fame. Yeah, it's like right. Social game.
And like,
yeah.
I think that there is something like kind of legitimately trenchant about this idea that like these people who have like, you can take the sort of the people out of the small town or not, but you can't take the small town out of the people sort of thing, where like Kirstie Alley is so obsessed with how she felt when she was Miss Teen America that's all that matters to her, even though she has done things that are objectively like she should have moved on from this, right? And like, I think that like that explanation of why like nostalgia and the power of something like a small town pageant resonates is like a better point than I think you get in a lot of these things, where it's like, oh, like this movie actually has something to say about like why these people can't move on from this sort of thing, right? Like, and it's like, oh, it like is so different for low class people than it is for higher class people, right? It's like there is no particular power that this pageant holds over somebody like Kirsten Dunst, right? She just wants the money. She wants to win because she wants to get out of town. Whereas with the higher class people, it has nothing to do with winning for money or anything else. It's about like leveraging their superiority over the people in their town. They want to stay where they are and remain on top, whereas the people under them are not interested in playing that hierarchy game. They're interested in getting out, right? And so like there is actually like a really interesting like commentary here on like what these sort of like hierarchical corrupt contests of beauty and youth and talent and potential are really for, and who they seem to really be about propping up. And it's, you know, it's people who want not necessarily to actually celebrate those things so much as they want to maintain a status quo, because that is what allows them to feel good about themselves, right? And so like there is a really interesting exchange happening there. Cody, what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. There is something that started to click for me again, like during the pageant, that extended set piece where it's, you know, essentially procedural, and we're going through different trials and roadblocks, specifically through the Amber Atkins character, where it all starts to come together, this sort of like small town inevitability. So like we're maybe kind of pulling back to the geographic, you know, specific geographic nature of this movie a little bit. That is something that I gravitate toward a lot in movies where it's characters like trapped within or confined to a specific area, not necessarily by like concrete walls, but from like ideological means. A movie like this, a movie that I have been pretty vocal about how much I love it, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, has like some similar things going on, which is funny because that's something I never felt about growing up in Minnesota. Not that Rochester is like a small town or anything, but like I loved where I grew up and I did not like it. Like it was, you know, I was not trapped to that specific area. So movies that sort of paint the opposite are genuinely like particularly fascinating to me. And that is something we see a lot here where Amber is somebody who, like it's been said, wants to get out. The vast majority of people involved with this, like they've accepted that this town is bought and this competition is rigged, and they're just not completely indifferent. They just kind of, you know, they shake their fists at the heavens, they roll their eyes more than anything, and then they just kind of go back home. They're sort of resigned to their fate. So there is, I think trenchant is a word that one of you guys said, but there is something like trenchant and sobering about that is permeating all of this, but it doesn't. As it's also been said, I'm just kind of piggybacking on everything, but I agree that it's not something that overwhelms the film, and it's something that like it definitely could have. The fact that this is shouting out, I don't know, other geographically focused movies that I love. I recently revisited Everybody Wants Some, and that has a sort of like frontiers are where you find them sort of through line to everything. And like we risk not getting that in a movie like this. Not to say that this movie is like the best of that, but you want Amber Atkins to be the sort of redeemed, like plucky hero. And at every turn, she's at risk of not getting that because the powers that be are like stealing her costumes or like trying to murder her or any other sort of thing. And she's still in Minnesota. She still is like very much that same kid from small town conservative Minnesota. But by the end, she does like, she has found the frontier, and other characters as well have they have that that classic sort of Animal House, like, where are they now sort of gag. And like,
Niedermeyer was killed by his own troops in Vietnam.
Exactly. Well, I was going to say nothing that intense, but then you think about the Kirstie Alley character. I got to stop calling her Kirstie Alley. The Gladys Lehman. There we go. There are other frontiers that are found. Some of them are, again, resigned to their fate. Some of them got out, but like in like a less glorious situation. But Amber got out, and that is we're kind of pinning all our hopes to her. And again, all of that works in tandem super well. So it's not just like an Amber Atkins like hero's journey. It's not like 100% black comedy. It's not 100% like let's mockingly look at a region of the country that not a lot of people know about and sort of resigning this movie to cult status. I think all of that works in conjunction pretty well. It makes a great fucking movie, but also like feeds positively into that sort of cult status and like, I don't know, operates this sort of mechanized ascent to where like, hopefully, you know, more people have found this over time and have come to love it. But that's just me shooting from the hip. Harry, does any of that sing for you?
No, yeah, absolutely. I think that like specifically the thing that I really love about this movie's class politic and sort of like class psychology is that the people who are rigging this, they're the only people who think this is real. It, right, is ironically the people who are making it not real. It's like everybody else knows that this is a fucked up like bullshit pageant. Like Allison Janney's character says as much. She's like, yeah, the people who are going to win are the people who run this town, the rich people, because every time they take a shit it's front page news, right? Like she says that, and it's like it's not even worthwhile really for like these people, these rich people, to do this, right? Like even the dad is obviously so put upon and affected. Like he's drinking in every scene, he's rolling his eyes at the whole thing, but he ended up sponsoring all of it, and he ultimately ends up getting his daughter killed because he takes such corners with the construction of his big giant swan or whatever, which is also hilarious. But like I really think that like there is something, especially as somebody who like there's something so true to the critique of small town here where it's like, I love that like this movie as a starting ground says like, yes, we know that, you know, that pageants are stupid. They don't matter. The kind of the people involved in them on some level know that. So why do they still operate? Right. And it like, it has this very dark, but I think very true commentary on how sort of like to be low class in America means to play the games of these like narcissistic, self-aggrandizing people. And like, I kind of love how that even loops into like ultimately, for instance, how Kirsten Dunst's character gets out, right? Like Kirsten Dunst gets a job as a reporter, which he's always wanted, because fucking Lehman shoots a reporter on camera while trying to shoot her, and then she picks up the microphone and runs with it, right? And it's like there's this sort of like this absurdity to the entire idea of the universe and the entire idea of America, right? Where it's like, yeah, like this is the story about a bunch of people who have been marginalized and who are being like kept marginalized because of the way that they are treated, because of the opportunities that are presented to them, right? Like here we have like Kirsten Dunst's character, and to a lesser extent, the other women in this movie, they've got one chance to get out of Rosemount, right? And what is that one chance? It's a rigged beauty pageant where they not only know that they're not actually going to win, but in the process they have to debase themselves, right? They have to pretend like they care about this shit. They have to like pretend like they have to sort of like sell themselves, right? And that's kind of what this is all about. And then like I really like the through line that like Kirsten Dunst, like she is sort of successful in the weird way that characters in this movie can be successful, because she keeps her eyes on what matters, right? Like she wants to maintain relationships with her mom. She wants to like be somebody other than like not a pageant queen, but somebody beyond that, right? And she has these friendships that are genuine that she cultivates within this. That's what allows her to get as far as she does in the pageant in the first place, right? Brittany Howard ends up giving her costume and everything. And so I think that like weirdly, and it's funny because like when I think about this movie, I don't really think about class, and I don't really think about satire, or I don't really think about like class satire or American satire. I think about the comedy mostly. But like I do think there is something really good about this idea that like, hey, like you have to like everybody who wants something in this country like has to go through basically a pageant that's run by the worst people you know, right? And like that's fucking capitalism, baby, you know? And like I think that there is something really fascinating there about that, especially for teen girls specifically, right? And especially teen girls at the turn of the century, right? It's just sort of like, yeah, like, man, every woman I know has had to like do something that they would rather not do for like money or status or something, right? And like never for a good reason, always for just like they have some other thing that they want, and this is the way they do that, right?
Exactly. And I just to like ping pong it back, I think one of the, I mean, this movie sells that deeper stuff by virtue of often being extremely funny. And so like we've danced around this. I feel like it's fair to like open the floodgates a little bit more. Just like, what are the, like, we've called out a lot of them so far, I think, but I feel like if there's like a set piece or like a subplot or even like a specific character, a couple of characters that like really like sold this for y'all, that's the shit I'm really curious about, of just like, you know, when you're selling this to not necessarily us, but like people who have never seen this, like, what are you like, what are you going to cite as like, this is a funny movie. This is some of the funniest shit though. When like this person said this thing or when they did this thing, like what is that for y'all? Drew, as being somewhat of a comedic aficionado, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Let me just go down my Rolodex. Yeah. Of thoughts that I have.
Please do. Yeah. Dog-eared pages.
Yeah. I think some of like the most brilliant, like physical comedy that they do, is with the, where they set up the whole scenario where the ladders were painted late, and so that they have to do the dance and they're wearing white shorts and there's blue and white paint on them and they're getting it all over and they're sitting on it, like that the whole setup and the payoff of that is really funny physical comedy, and like it's just not done anymore in the same way. Like we don't see like funny stuff like that again. It reminds me of, you know, Waiting for Guffman or, you know, some of that type of stuff, you know, where you see funny performances. When we see at the beginning of the movie, Kirstie Alley's character, Gladys Lehman, coming up with, having her brain blast of, oh my gosh, I finally came up with this year's theme, proud to be an American. And then you rarely hear the production team's voice, but they're like, what was last year's theme? And they're like, USA is A-okay. And they're like, and what was your favorite theme? And she's like, oh, I can think of it. Can I think of it? I can. Like she just like, and she's like, I have a gift from God. Like that whole segment is just so funny. It's not like that those puns are funny. It's that the way it's played with her character and like that she thinks that she's actually smart and funny. And like that part's so funny. And of course, I think that the probably like the scene that steals the show is when you see each character's performance. You get to see their talent. I mean, most people's, and you know, you just sort of get to see each of their personalities. Even some of the people that get very little screen time, you have a great sense of their character just from their initial interview with the docuseries and then their performance. Some people only really get that, you know, like the girl who has sign language, right? Like you really, she's like, here's what I'm going to do. I do sign language. And then you see her do her sign language and it's pretty funny. But specifically the scene where you don't know exactly who Rebecca Ann Lehman is going to be singing, Can't Keep My Eyes Off of You about, it's some special guy. And then the reveal is that it's a dummy of Jesus on the cross that she proceeds to dance with on stage to that song. And that song is also, you know, heavily featured in, famously featured in 10 Things I Hate About You, which I think came out the year before or the same year, which, interesting. I don't know exactly what was going on in the water that caused that. But I think, like that bit is an all-time favorite when thinking of this. I think some of the timing is really good when, for example, they have the girl ride over the hill on the tractor only to explode directly afterwards. That's really funny, the way that they time that stuff. And yeah, just some of the Minnesota-isms, like it's almost hard to point them out, but it's because there's some of them are like so subtle in the way that people act or the shots, you know, the, like, you know, how Aaron mentioned, like, it's just like a shot of like a pancake breakfast sign. And it's like, that's not a joke, but for us it is. And so like, I don't know if I can necessarily point all those out, but like, I would say that the pervasive Minnesotan-ness of the way that things look is like funny in a way, to someone who grew up during that time. I also know that when they were said that the Mall of America, they're not like they're at like the Dyna. They're like, I think they're at Southdale. I don't know. Like, I feel like I saw them at right. Southdale.
That definitely was not the Mall of America.
Correct. Yeah. It's some other parking lot. Yeah. So those are definitely all the places that stand out to me. But like, there's literally countless more that I'm sure we'll hear about from other people.
Definitely. I think the like, and furthermore, thinking about the, like you name dropped a lot of characters, essential ones, and like they all have their, it's not just like different, like different instances of the same like flavor of character, just like doing quips. Like there's interiority to all of these, like Gladys Lehman right off the bat. Coming up, I mean, it becomes more apparent later, but like a veiled sort of villain who like is like giving you certain things and like hiding other things at various points. So, and like depending on who she's talking to, if it's to the camera or to Amber or to somebody else, and like comparing that to her daughter, Becky Lehman, Denise Richards, who is just like by comparison a tap dancing villain who's like I'm just drawing the comparison now, but like kind of how Steve Buscemi's like the one character in Fargo not toting like some kind of Minnesota or otherwise accent, thinking of like the Peter Stormare character, like Denise Richards being this sort of foreign element where it's like, I don't know, I look it up every time I watch this movie of like, did she do that on purpose? Was it something that the director or writers told her to do? Or is she just like, nah, fuck that. I'm not going to try this cornball accent. Nice try, but I'll be in your silly Minnesota movie. But like, I hate it on some level, but also love it because it is her just like being in a completely different picture, and especially her juxtaposed next to the likes of Amy Adams, who's like purring while saying Brett Favre's name, and Brittany Murphy, who's like nailing the subtlety as well as anybody with regards to the accent that we're talking about. Yeah, the big sort of Drew, you cited just her unstoppable giggling or just never ending chuckles, whatever it is that she's doing. Like that just props up the maniacal nature of Becky Lehman a little more. I think all of that works super well. And Amber being like still not being an unfunny character, definitely like being the sort of straight man for the whole thing. Like, I think she serves that really well as sort of like the level head. There are definitely some scenes or like some moments where like, I guess more so credit to the writing feeding into the performances, but where Amber's like, oh, it was like, luckily for me, the one thing that wasn't unscathed was that my first costume of the pageant, which was just like lying pressed and untouched on the roof of like the nearby trailer or the next, you know, whatever, the neighbor's house or something like that. So it's, yeah, I like more depth to these, like, it's not just like talking heads of character again, like similar instances of the same character, just like doing what the screenwriter believed to be just like, oh, these are good jokes that are like punching down at a region. Like it's all of that is kind of folding in on itself, I think, pretty positively, at least for my money.
Yeah. I mean, I think that even more so than the jokes themselves, which I think that there are a lot of really funny jokes in this movie. The ones that really get to me the most tend to be weirdly the, the jokes about rural conservatism, specifically in the Midwest, like the fact that like Allison Janney's character Denise Richards is like the captain of the gun club, and she keeps talking about all the guns she got when she was 13 and 15. The one sort of like scene that Kirsten Dunst has with a boy before the boy dies, which also love. I think that's like a really interesting signal. I think somebody wrote about how in this movie it's like genuinely kind of refreshing that like boys and romance are like such a non-factor here. Like everybody, like all of the women, like the interesting relationships they have in this movie are with their moms, right? Like that is the big relationship at the heart of this movie, is two women and their moms. But anyway, they're like talking and Kirsten Dunst gets asked out and she's like, oh no, I don't think I can go on Friday. I probably have to work at the morgue. It's a busy season. And then there's a beat and both of them say in unison, hunting season. that's one of my favorite jokes in the whole movie. When Amy Adams is introduced, she does the school cheerleading dance, and it's Go Muskies. And then she puts her her hands up to her face, like to imitate gills, and makes like a puckered up face. So fucking funny. I think that for me, the heart of this movie is maybe the central four performances. I mean, you could argue there are Well, there are actually way more performances than that. I was thinking of the four women in the pageant itself, right? Which is just fucking insane to even say, but it's Kirsten Dunst, Amy Adams, Denise Richards, and Brittany Howard, which are like
Murphy.
Brittany Murphy, not Brittany Howard.
You said Brittany Howard earlier, and I was like,
"Oh yeah, did I?
Am I missing someone in the movie?"
Whoops, nope.
We watched the extended cut. Sorry, Drew. Yeah, should have told you.
For those of us who are me, who's Brittany Howard?
I don't remember. I just
musician.
If you are listening at home,
not related.
Why don't you look it up?
No, it's just me being
comment on Twitter, and you'll get a free ticket to come
see
Try Love Live.
Harry.
Thanks. She was in Alabama Shakes. Now she's gone solo. Alabama Shakes is a great band.
Kanishitake, excuse me.
Yeah. Anyway, so like I think that like for instance, like I don't think that like Amy Adams is a great written character, and I don't think Brittany Howard I just did it again, Brittany Murphy. Wow.
Invite her on the podcast. Yeah.
I don't think that Brittany Murphy except for her jokes about her brother in New York is a great character, but they just sell it so well. Like, I think that all four of those actresses are like already so good. Kirsten Dunst has like this amazing ability to be like totally self-aware until she's not. And she can turn that on and off like a light switch just perfectly. I think probably my favorite performance in the entire movie is Denise Richards, who like is so fucking perfect as this like sociopath, like pageant queen, where like just the way that she smiles and that smile doesn't reach her eyes, the way that she is so perfectly composed and yet so obviously poisonous. It's so, I don't know. She's so good in this movie and like so perfect for, like as a foil to, her mom's character, Kirstie Alley's character, who is also amazing in this movie. So I think that like, I think that this movie, I have legitimate grievances with its writing, but the acting really picks up where the writing leaves off in a way that like is super satisfying, right? Like, I think it makes a lot of the broadness of the humor or a lot of the jokes that aren't actually that good or that compelling. It really puts them over the top for me. Brittany Murphy and Denise Richards in particular are just amazing for that.
Totally agree. Aaron, what was funny to you? What tickled your funny bone, my guy?
Outside of some of the more like crude jokes in this, I think like I enjoyed how vulgar and like violently slapstick it got at times. I think that like the tractor blowing up, real funny, right? I think maybe this is my caveman brain, but like the light falling out and hitting the woman on the head while she's dancing around, hilarious.
And then Kirsten Dunst perfectly selling that light was meant for my head. One scene later,
yeah,
really
that
good.
Light was meant for my head.
I think that like I like black humor quite a bit, and I like humor that is maybe like every once in a while I like humor that's just kind of mean spirited in a way. Not to justify any of the more kind of, you know, badly aged stuff in this movie, but I think that there is like a mean-spirited nature with which it kind of handles its subjects that I find kind of refreshing, despite the fact that the movie also is accurate and specific enough to handle those topics with care. It's like this weird juxtaposition of like it is very clearly portraying what it's portraying and like what I view to be like a pretty accurate light, right? At least like the Minnesota stuff, but a lot of the other stuff as well, and like small town sensibilities and like, yeah, the way small town people just kind of latch on to this one thing that their town has going on and like hype it up above everything else. Like I view that as like pretty accurate, at least to my experiences. But then like the film like kind of throws that all away just to like make very, very vulgar, dark, mean-spirited jokes about those characters, and like I kind of like that. There's something that I find weirdly refreshing about it, to be quite honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like it's mean-spirited, but like, and we talked about this with Waiting for Guffman, but I think this movie can be hateful, but I think that like where it counts, it doesn't feel hateful, right? Like I don't think that this movie like genuinely hates its characters.
No,
even the ones that it's like making fun of the whole time, right? Like,
but I also don't. This movie's not like overly sweet towards them either, in a way that
not at all.
Yeah, Yes, right. I dig that vibe, I
yeah,
guess.
Like, Allison Janney's character is a perfect example, right? Because, like, I love that character. I think she's a queen, right? Like, I think she's iconic. But also, like, she is just the butt of the joke. Like, there is no, like, annoying saccharine office redemptive arc for her, right? Like, she is just a, like, alcoholic sex addict.
Yeah, The Office, right? Is good, but Parks and Rec was the one that really fucked this all up.
Sure.
Parks and Rec was the one that's like, we need every single one of these bad villain characters to come around and see Leslie
have a
Knope
redemptive
side.
Arc.
Like,
sure.
No, let lights fall on them and fucking brain them to death. You know what I mean? Just like, it's okay sometimes just to get
blow up Jeremy Jam on a tractor.
Yes, just like fucking have her be a fucking sniper on top of a hardware store or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
which is hilarious because the first season of Parks and Rec went too far in the other direction. Where the first season of it's unwatchable because of how mean spirited it is and how much it clearly like hates its characters. And then they went way too far in the other direction.
A lot of people have talked about the Parks and Rec. Yes, like season like 2 or 3, going like, we should just make this The Office. I think we'll make a lot more money if we just make this The Office. You know, it's fine. But yeah, I
agree. Like, this feels very distinct, right? This does not feel at all like The Office. It feels closer to Waiting for Guffman, but it feels like its own thing to me, right? Like, despite being something that is like mockumentary at this point is so overdone. Maybe the fact that like it came before those things redeems that, but I also think that they just maybe found like an actual, like, I don't know, the humor is broader, right? Like, the humor is this, at no point does this feel like an actual mockumentary, right? It feels like a super like over the top, like hyper reality. And
it does not address the camera being in the room except for when the camera needs to be in the room
Bit. Right.
I get my general take that I'm formulating that might just be me hating TV is that I think like as that mockumentary style started to bleed over to television, that's when it kind of got effed out in a weird way. Where like I was fine with just Guffman's and Spinal Taps and Drop Dead Gorgeouses. I think once it's 11 seasons of a TV show of that kind of a style and it's the most popular media property in the United States, like that's maybe where it's like, okay, I think I've maybe had enough of this. I think we can call the mockumentary over for now. Take a break on mockumentaries. Give it 10 years, come back. We'll see. But maybe I'm just a hater.
Yeah, you're just a hater. I think most of America loves the mockumentary, and they're never going to stop making it. We got What You Do in the Shadows. We got Abbott Elementary. Like, it's still going strong.
Is it Abbott Elementary a mockumentary, too?
Oh, yeah. It's, like, in the style of, like, Parks and Rec. Right?
Oh, okay.
It's not, they don't address the camera, like, in the way that The Office does.
Sure.
More like Parks and Rec. When it comes to format of this movie, I think we haven't addressed, like, the pacing trick that it pulls on the audience. Like, I don't know if you would call that a joke exactly, but it is a trick that is played on the audience. And maybe if you're smart enough and, you know, with modern technology, you can see it coming because you're watching the bar tick by and you know the runtime or whatever. But, like, it has, like, a missing act, like, on purpose, right? Like, they set you up for an act that doesn't exist. Like, they kind of rip it away from the audience. And, like, that's almost part of the joke that, like, the unfulfilled nature of like the arc of
very
the plot
much so. Yeah.
is one of the jokes. And like when it comes to something that's funny about the film, it's like, it's a bit more broad than the word joke, but like, it's a funny trick that you have to be really bold to play on the audience because in almost any other movie. And even I felt a little bit like annoyed by it when I watched the first time, and in almost any movie, it's like, shuts down the movie. It's like, what do you mean the movie's over? Like, what are you talking about? You wanted to trick me into thinking there was more movie or that there was going to be more resolution or whatever it is, right? Like, what do you mean? Like, you know, they would have had test audience would have been mad. And maybe that's part of what the critical reception problem it had on release. I don't know. I mean, I have no idea what, you know, I was 7 when the movie came out, so I have no idea what people were actually thinking who were thinking adults. But, it's a very bold narrative trick to pull. It's adjacent to comedy.
I'm super glad you brought that up because it sounds like similarly to you, the pacing of this movie really works for me. And I think it's kind of shitty, like objectively, right? Like, I think that like, for one thing, like the pageant ends, the frame story for this movie ends 2/3 of the way through the movie. And then the movie just has like a slack 20 minutes. And that slack 20 minutes at the end of it is like all come down. Like there is no, and they kind of set you up for a false second climax. And then that doesn't happen either. So you're left with this movie that feels like it should be an hour long that is inexplicably 90 minutes long, right? It's like, The main bad guy of the movie, Kirstie Alley, is called out. She is sent to prison. Kirsten Dunst, like sort of like by virtue of being the only person left standing, is the winner of the pageant. Then there's nationals, and then there's like, or there's regionals, and then there's nationals. And both of those are also just like silly, like joke fake outs, right? Where like everybody at regionals or statewide gets sick from seafood. They all throw up. Kirsten Dunst is the only one who didn't eat the seafood, so she wins. And then they go to nationals and they find out that the fucking makeup company who sponsored it was shut down for tax evasion. And so the IRS raided them and like closed all their properties. And they show up on the bus and literally they show up to a closed, defunct building. And then the last scene in this movie is the would-be teen princess is tearing the building down, right? And Kirsten Dunst gets back on the bus. And then we get our Animal House cut to credits. It's so weird, right? Like it's just like one fake out after another, one sort of like, oh, are we going to start a second movie about nationals? And then it's like, no, we're not actually, because like we actually just made this joke about how corrupt and how anticlimactic this sort of thing is from the ground up, which I really love. There's something so anticlimactic to me about like pageantry in general, right? Is that like the winner wins and then like there is this weird like hangover period where like they kind of showed it ever afterward, right, where everybody's leaving and they're all sort of like, that was something, like and now it's over and like that didn't actually mean anything and we're moving on. And so I think that there's something really like appropriate about the strangeness of this movie's pacing and plotting, especially like as a recreation of the feeling of pageantry. But I also agree that like it is such a deeply strange choice for this movie. It like it leaves you with like this, like I was checking my watch every 3 minutes, like for the remainder of the movie after the pageant, right? Because I was just like, how is this movie not over? Like the movie's over. I should be like done with this, but there are still 25 minutes left on this bad boy. So like something must happen and then nothing happens. Right. And I kind of like that about it, to be honest.
Honestly, me too. And I think the pacing of this podcast is very comparable to that of Drop Dead Gorgeous. I don't know. Segways or Jason's thing. Any other big points that y'all want to put forth before we get to the handful of remaining segments that we have of this podcast? Any other big points before we get into like junk drawers and other things? Anything big that we didn't get to that y'all want to throw out there?
I would say that like, it's almost uncanny how like for every two jokes that hit, there's one that is an absolute clunker in this movie. But something about that like kind of like works for me, right? Like there's one like judge and they're brothers. They own a hardware store. One of the brothers is mentally handicapped from birth, right? And like that's the whole joke, is that this dude, everybody calls him the R word and he's constantly doing weird stuff in the background, and they go back to that well so many times. It is like both offensive and just like deeply unfunny. Like even if it wasn't offensive, it's like there is nothing even resembling comedy happening in any of those scenes. Like at one point the pedophile attacks the like handicapped brother, and like it just like, but there is stuff like that, right, where like there's another pageant character who is a white girl who was adopted by a Japanese family, and like it eventually, like in a very weird subtle way, is implied that like they were afraid of nuclear devastation, and so they like decided to become super American to try to avoid that. And that's another joke that's just like, what the fuck is going on with this movie? So yeah, I don't know. It's like, again, it's a weird thing, right? Where like, to me, that is a part of the whole of the movie, right? That like there's this weird cadence where for every time you start to get into a groove, that groove is disrupted by two or three jokes that are just absolute dog shit. And then you move on and it keeps working.
The handling of the mentally handicapped brother is obviously the most like badly aged, like, worst part of this movie. There is one joke in there that probably got the biggest laugh of the movie for me, which was the joke about the babysitter being dead. That got me real good, but not the juice was not worth the squeeze in that regard, I would say.
It wasn't even a good joke. It was, I mean, sure, it was funny in that.
Just something about the very pitiful way that he said that. It was all in the delivery, yeah. Not really in the writing for me there.
I was going to ask which part was funny about it. Yeah.
It's conceptually not very funny. Just the idea that, like, yeah, the babysitter died for some reason. Why did the babysitter die? Who knows?
Maybe it was a mouse situation of mice and men and he killed the babysitter. Would that be too dark? I don't know.
Probably too dark, yeah. Would have fit this film, maybe. But yeah.
It was all implied, though, I think, in the subtext.
That's what we're all about here on Trial of the Subtext. As we pivot to the first of our remaining segments, I will go ahead and open the junk drawer.
Do you need some oil? It's like those hinges are pretty rusty. It's
what are you talking about? Junk drawer. That's exactly how it's supposed to sound. That's what makes it a junk drawer. The fact that you can hear it across, you know, the entire neighborhood block whenever it gets opened. It just sounds
all right.
I guess, yeah, part of that was mine, but none of that came from me opening a drawer. It was me like shaking something. We're peeling back the layers here. But any other sort of more micro thoughts that y'all had that maybe don't belong to a larger point? Just some like call outs, gags that you want to reference that you didn't get the chance to mention. Now is the time for that.
How did they get Adam West to agree to
do
this movie, to be agreed to be, I guess, the butt of a joke, which is he's slept with a teenager.
Dude, he could not have known about that joke. Like, they straight up didn't tell him about that joke, right?
I mean, yeah, but then wouldn't he just, like, not agree to not be in the movie at a certain point? Like, also the little text at the bottom saying Adam West was not available for comment. Great. That's a great bit. I don't know how they got him, but
He must just be like, all right, guys, yeah, like, defame me, fam. Like, what? Like,
yeah, probably. Why not? You know,
defame me, fam. I can't do Adam West. It's like part Dom Pardo. I don't know what to do. I bet Drew's got a good Adam West. Put you on the spot.
What? I can't. I'm Adam so West. Bad at impressions.
Yeah.
There's like a game, a comedy sports game, where you're supposed to do impressions, and I hate it because, like,
fair.
I can't conjure. I could do British, and that's about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah.
What if Adam West was a British man?
Yeah, what would that sound like? I wonder.
Yeah, wow. Well, we'll all be wondering.
Yeah, we'll never know, I guess. Yeah, that's true.
Up to you, listener.
Another thought. Very, very 90s. There are like a bunch of eating disorder jokes in this movie. Holy shit, does that shit not age well. There's like the previous champion of Miss Teen America is like permanently hospitalized for anorexia. And, like, they just make a bunch of jokes about how funny it is that a woman would have an eating disorder.
And, like, the joke is just that, like, everyone is like, yeah, that's just how she is. Like, and we care for her, and but we're not going to fix it.
Right. And, like, it's a good example of sort of, like, in a different movie, that would be more egregious than it is in this movie. Because the satire of the whole institution is so latent. Right. It's almost like and I'm not excusing this joke. I don't think it's a good joke. I don't necessarily think it belongs in this movie even. But like it's like we don't need to do anything more with that eating disorder joke because like you already know that this pageant is so fucked. Right. Like and that the entire culture about pageants is so fucked. It's almost like Little Miss Sunshine approach to like the satire of pageantry where it's like, it's already like you already know this. It's lazy. It's hand wavy and they used it to make a bad joke. But like there's something about that like is not as offensive to me as a consequence, I guess. And then there is a pretty good joke where then after Kirsten Dunst's mom, played by Ellen Barkin, who is also great in this movie, by the way, I love her in this movie. After she's burned and she has a Miller Lite or a Miller High Life can like permanently affixed to her arm, we cut back to the hospital where we had earlier been to see the sign that said eating disorders this way. And there's just one other indicator in the other direction. It's like hospital, eating disorders to the left, burn ward to the right. And then we like go right to the burn ward where we went to the eating disorders before. That was a visual joke that weirdly worked really well for me. All that is to say, bad, bad, bad jokes about anorexia. Don't do that. That's rough.
Don't do that. But do bring forth any other lingering thoughts y'all have before we close the drawer. Going once.
They had that part. Man, I don't know why this is something that I'm bringing up, but it's something that I remember catching is when they imply that the girl liked to ride around on her tractor because she was like getting sexual gratification.
Oh, yeah.
It's like they just quickly throw it in. They move on. It's almost like some of the speed, the pacing
joke.
In there.
The smoking joke is very good. Where she's
the smoking joke is also funny too. And it's, they're one and the same joke, but like it's almost like if you're not paying close enough attention, it's like it reminds me of 30 Rock. If you're not paying close enough attention, you're going to miss the joke. Like that's two jokes about the same thing, and you can miss them both. Like you can just be like, oh, like you might just hear, if you're not really watching, you might just hear she likes to ride her tractor.
Yeah. Well, and that's the perfect example of how good Kirsten Dunst's performance is that like she is able to affect the exact right amount of like self-awareness for every joke, even though that is a constantly moving goalpost, right? Like there she is able to completely sell that joke as something she doesn't understand. She's just like, and besides, I know that Tammy only smoked after a nice tractor ride. And she just
I know for a fact that Tammy only smoked after a tractor
and just,
ride.
Like, completely. And then later on, like there are different levels of irony that she has to affect throughout this movie, and she hits them all like immaculately, despite the fact that there's like no consistency to it, and she makes it work, right? And I really like that about this performance.
All right, everybody, rank it: Jumanji, Spider-Man, this film, Kirsten Dunst's performance. Rank them.
Just her performance or the movies? Just
this
the
is. We're not ranking the movies. This is a Kirsten Dunst ranking because she's in each one.
Of those
this
three.
Spider-Man, I haven't seen Jumanji in a while. I'm going to assume it's the worst. I'm going to go this. Spider-Man, Jumanji.
I think that is my ranking. Yeah. As far as her performance, like she's
she
really
like
good
a
in this.
Little kid in Jumanji, wasn't she?
Like a year or two younger than this, I think.
Sorry,
yeah, like,
do better.
Oh, that,
all,
see,
also,
that,
yeah, get good.
That TDH. Is the, fucking better the actor. Wild thing that kind of like freaks me out about going back to this movie in particular is that like this movie came out like I think Spider-Man came out 3 years later, and like my feelings about Kirsten Dunst in the Spider-Man movie are so different from my feelings
yeah,
about her
how is it
in
the
this
same
movie.
Person?
Yeah. Yeah. And also like I was a kid, right? But like Kirsten Dunst was like maybe my first Mary Jane was like my first like holy shit, that's a woman type of like feeling that I had about a movie. And then like to like be confronted with the fact that she was basically a teenager is like kind of a frightening prospect for me. I'm sounding like John Doe right now, so we should move forward.
Yeah,
you
didn't actually have to rank them.
Just for like
I was just trying to get a gradient of her performances, right? Like we've seen her range is broad.
When did Bring It On come out, by the way?
I think that was 98, 99. Oh, was it?
2001. Okay.
They're maybe it was right 99.
I will also throw in Small Soldiers, which was like a movie, like a VHS tape that I watched a lot as a kid. Like, honestly, yeah, like Kirsten Dunst earnestly to semi-earnestly embracing like wackadoo premises in movies. Like Small Soldiers is as wackadoo as it gets. I mean, but Joe Dante, you know, kind of getting the most out of everything. I don't know. I fucking love that movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's that's a perfect cult movie, right? In that it's like it's kind of bad, but also I love it so dearly.
Small Soldiers is just Toy Story as ants is to Bug's Life.
Oh god, you're killing me. But you're right.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Also, like Charlie pointed out that like Kirsten Dunst is the most obviously not dancing that anyone ever has been in her
tap
scenes.
Dancing? Oh, yeah.
And but which was surprising to me because she does dance in Bring It On, right? Like, isn't that the whole thing of that movie?
Or, no, it's cheerleading. That's not dancing. Yeah,
I feel like tap dancing fair. Is a real specific niche.
That's true.
Not
that's true.
Related. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what about when she tanced down? Oh, we never talked about this. This is really important. When she's wearing her headphones and she tap dances down the street to like some. Like grunge rock music.
It rules, yeah.
But it's also only like 8 seconds of that song in footage.
Almost 1999.
Yeah, her whole character is such a vibe. Kelly pointed that out too. It's like she works in a morgue, but she is like super bright and happy all the time. She like works in a trailer or lives in a trailer. She worships Alice and Janney. It's like there are a lot of like broad characters in this movie. I love how specific Kirsten Dunst's character is. She's like, I really just like a lot of the choices they made about her in this movie.
Same here. Same here. Do we want to end the drunk door sesh?
That's it.
Yeah, let's do it. Seems like a good note to end on. So I'll go ahead, close this drawer, and pivot to We'll pivot to this one. Shouldn't take very long. It is a segment called Other Loves We've Tried. Actually, fuck it. Jason's got Other Loves We've Tried to all the loves we've tried before. There we go. Keeping in cadence with the
classic.
Now we're cooking, boys. So just a quick rundown of other films that came out in the same year of this movie that we've covered in previous episodes. We've called out a handful of them already, which is awesome. But the year 1999, going down the line in order of episode release date, we've got 10 Things I Hate About You. That was episode 84 with special guest Taylor Zastro. Yes, that was episode 84. Try not to think too much about it for those of us here who were there for that recording. Episode 137, But I'm a Cheerleader with special guests Emily Sui and Charlie Mackin. A lot of special guests for the 1999 episodes, spoilers, and that continues to episode 178 with Bringing Out the Dead, also with Charlie Mackin. Charlie having a thing with 1999 movies, which is very cool.
God, it's so funny that we had her on that episode.
In retrospect, yeah, kind of. No guest for Ratcatcher, but that was episode 221. That was
nobody wanted to be on Ratcatcher, huh?
I'm looking around.
Discuss that feel good film.
Polar opposite of this movie in every single way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They are,
except
they
for that children die in both of them.
It's true. Good point, Harry. Good point.
Pretty good. 1999 was quite a vibe, and it concludes, at least as far as this segment goes, with episode 249, The Blair Witch Project, with special guests women. We had a lot of cool women on that episode. So that was To All the Loves We've Tried Before. No sound effect for that one. Maybe we'll add one later. Otherwise, or I don't know, hopefully not, because the last thing this needs is more segments and bits. But we do have one more to contend with, and I will pivot. I'll turn it over to Harry to lead us into the final segment.
Is this going to be a solo mish for me? Just a big old solo?
Well, you can communicate it with Drew. We'll see if Drew wants to join in for this intro.
If you want to join in for the introduction to this final segment, you can.
I don't sing, so I don't. Yeah.
That's fair. You're on mute,
sorry,
Drew.
I feel like you should just go for it and I'll have a reaction to
Excellent.
It.
Okay, great. This is the segment that we like to call Cody's Noties.
Wow. Thank you for
it's
that.
It's kind of to the sister-sister theme.
That's
not
better
really,
than it usually is. What's different this time, folks? Yeah. I don't know.
As a former Humble Stats major, sorry, I cannot tell the causation.
If it
causality.
Was actually to the Cody's or the sister-sister theme, it would be Cody's
Noties. I was like, there's a pause there.
But yeah, you're right.
Never knew how
much
he
wrote these. Oh, that, yeah, yeah, oh, wow. Whoa.
No, yours made sense. Mine said toadies.
Well, funnily enough, this segment is about frogs. No, thank you. That was, in all seriousness, a great introduction. Just like bars before a hot dish. Talked a lot about Minnesota this week. Our purpose here today is to find out who will be crowned 2024's Miss Trilove. Da, 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 da. I didn't add any other sound effects to the soundboard.
It's Maggie Chung. We're done. We got it.
All right. Thank you for listening to Trilove this week. No, so one at a time, I will read off a trivia item inquiry related to an actor who got part of their start in beauty pageants. I'll use a spinner app to determine the answering order for each question. I'll just like hold it up to my webcam here, Drew. We'll just see where the spinner lands, just to kind of randomize the order, make it a little more fun for us here because we're not having enough fun, or we can never have enough fun. You be the judge. Points will be awarded based on correctness of the guess. Trivia Mafia rules apply here, and that just means use your noodles, not your Googles, to obtain the answers that you seek or something with that. Let's go ahead and jump in, and we're going to start with Halle Berry, who won Miss Teen All-American 1985 and Miss Ohio USA in 1986. She was the 1986 Miss USA first runner-up, and that same year, she was the first African-American Miss World entrant. How tall is Halle Berry? That is the question that we are going with. Drew, we always have one of these, not to give it away too much, but the first guess is going to come from Harry. Harry, how tall is Halle Berry, Harry?
I feel like I could say this about every one of these questions so far, but imagine you're in 1986 and you're competing for Miss Ohio and fucking Halle Berry strides up. It's like, ah, god damn it. I guess second place isn't bad. That's wild. I'm going to go with 5'6". Cody, I almost said Jason because that's your name on the recording.
Yeah, Yeah, it's true. I don't want to touch that. God knows I don't want him to be labeled as Cody forever. It's something of a curse that I would not wish upon anyone except myself. But I got your guess noted. Thank you for that. And we will head to Aaron for our next guess. Aaron, how tall is Halle Berry?
I am picturing myself standing up and Halle Berry in front of me, and I'm picturing that she is 5'8".
5'8". Locking that in, etching that guess in a concrete slab, and I don't need to spin it. I don't know why I did that, because Drew is the only one.
Who might it land on? Yeah,
it did land on Drew. I'm not going to do that every time. Everybody gets one. But Drew, how tall is Halle Berry, do you think?
Well, I know two things about Halle Berry, and the first one is that she's featured as one of the donuts in the Albuquerque long Weird Al song, when they're out of all the different kinds of donuts.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's one of the
got
things.
Any, you know, they're like, oh, you got any strawberry donuts? You got any raspberry donuts? That's you got amazing. Any Halle Berry donuts? No, we're out of Halle Berry donuts. So I know that one. And I also know that she plays Storm in X-Men, the first trilogy. She's not the young Storm. I don't know if I like the young Storm plotline. Mm-hmm. Not good.
That's
X-Men
fair.
Apocalypse, bad. Mm-hmm. But using the shared knowledge of those two facts, I will say that Halle Berry must be 5'7".
5'7" is what that logic train led us to. Thank you, Drew. The actual retail price of Halle Berry's height, according to online sources, she is allegedly 5'5". Little Storm. So 5'5", Harry gets the point for being closest. No Price is Right rules for going older greater, taller in this case. We go nearest. Harry was off by an inch. Harry gets the point. Next, we have another Academy Award winner on our hands. Was something I said funny? Sorry, do I need to pause?
The idea that, like, would you have given it that there's a rule set where, like, the higher you guess, the more right you are. So, like, even though I was the closest, like, well, but yeah, he guessed 5'8". That was the highest guess. So
that would be,
it's like, I'm just going to start guessing. Yeah, I think Halle Berry's 12 feet tall.
And then I'll just arbitrarily be like, oh, you guessed 12 feet? No, you fucking moron. Of course not. That's way too tall.
Yes.
1 million, Cody. I was like, wow, ding, 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 ding. We're going to talk about Michelle Yeoh now. Michelle Yeoh, another Academy Award winner. Halle Berry won Best Actress for, what was it? Monsters Ball. I'm going to stop going off script, but that's my segue. That's my transition to Michelle Yeoh, who was Malaysia's representative at Miss World 1983. A few years back, Yeoh featured in the miniseries The Witcher: Blood Origin, I believe, on Netflix. My question for you, what was Yeoh's salary per episode in The Witcher: Blood Origin? That's my question for you fine folks, and our first guest.
This is about to be real depressing.
well, not as depressing as it was for me trying to figure out what question to ask and landing upon a question about the Witcher series. But Drew gets the first crack at it. Drew, what do you think your salary per episode for Michelle Yeoh for The Witcher: Blood Origin?
Well, I have seen Everywhere, Everything, Everywhere, All the Time.
Yep.
And she's in that. And also, like, we know that The Witcher, like, it kind of sounds like they're doing a pun on Blood Orange. Like, I think it's supposed to sound like the fruit Blood Orange. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I heard, Witcher Blood Orange. Her salary, though, they're either really underpaying her or they're really overpaying her, depending on what you want me to think in this question. I'm going to go with she got paid $50,000 an episode.
$50,000, locking it in. Thank you, Drew. $50,000 per episode is the first guess. The second guess is going to come from Harry. Is that it? Oh, did Drew again? Damn, it was so close.
50,000.
You could just round. You know what I mean? Like,
nah,
you could.
Oh, I can't. I can't. This is all hail the magic conch. Harry is the next guesser. Harry, what do you think?
I'm shocked that show exists, first of all. I definitely think it's one of those, like, vaporware Netflix shows where, like, they advertise it, but it never actually happened, and they never get caught because nobody watches that shit.
True.
That being said, so I have no idea, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Of course,
I'm going to go with, like, I don't know, man, fucking $12,000 an episode.
$12,000. All right. Etching it in. And Aaron,
give Michelle some credit.
Yeah, she's a credited actor on the show.
What
do you want?
Here's the thing. What is the name of the show?
I have to look it up.
Love to Eat Juicy Blood Oranges.
The Witcher: Blood Origin.
Okay, I like so Drew's that's title a better. Witcher show. I feel like if there was another live action Witcher show, we'd all know about it.
It's not. It's
it must be an animated show. Okay, so it's an animated show. Voice acting. I mean, fucking, I have no clue. I'm gonna go with. I'm gonna go with $12,001 per episode.
Wow.
Of episode.
Wow, so you got prices right. In Colin Drew Carey.
Sorry, I think. You know, it's probably in like the 20 to 30 range. I hope I'll
spay and neuter your pets, folks.
Oh boy. Thank you for your guesses. Michelle Yeoh allegedly earned, I'm seeing $70,000 per episode of The Witcher Blood Origin, a show guys, that not a single person watched.
You guys, I was first. I had position disadvantage.
See, what I forgot is that Netflix is clearly an international money laundering operation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and they wrote that show off now that's been taken off.
Harry has played 300 hours of The Witcher 3, does not know about this television show based on The Witcher.
I should have had my webcam off the whole time.
I'm sorry, it's also a TV show and shit. Don't give me that, Cody. It's not just a video game. I know.
Harry, have you played through Witcher Guava?
No, I haven't gotten to that one yet. I'm excited.
Witcher Hawaiian Punch, yeah, my favorite flavor. Only 10 calories, but it tastes Witcher, almost as good as the usual one. Yeah,
I think we're covering the movie adaptation of the Guava spinoff next week, so I better get on that. I don't know what the fuck you guys are talking about. Moving along to number three, I guess actually first I'll pause. Drew and Harry both have a point apiece. Aaron still has yet to get on the board. Still very much anybody's game as we head into the third question. Which we're pivoting to another Michelle. It's my segue this time. Michelle Pfeiffer. In 1978, Pfeiffer won the Miss Orange County pageant and finished sixth in the Miss California contest. A question for you guys. Converted to Central Time. At what time of the day was Michelle Pfeiffer born? Is it fucked up that this information is on the public record? Probably. But you know what? We're going to roll with it. Because that's how we do it. Hey, and Harry... is the first sicko that has a guess at this question. When was Michelle Pfeiffer born? What time of day?
This is going to be good radio. First of all, I noticed that my background was the background color on the spinner before the spinner stopped spinning. I wonder if we can use that to figure out where the spinner stopped before it stops moving. Just keep an eye on it later on, guys. All of you listening at home, you can't
I'll test it here in the background.
Okay, sure. Yeah, thanks.
That has no bearing on it.
Harry, you do that. You let us know.
All right.
Yeah, you report back.
I'm gonna go with midnight. I think she was the lightning in the rain of the day that she was born, and you know, God himself tried to stop it from happening, but it to no avail because she was too powerful.
Right.
Clarification: the midnight here would be the exact beginning of that day.
The beginning of the day, yep.
In for rounding purposes. Okay.
Yes.
Yep. 12 a.m. Yep. Exactly. See, I did a test spin, and so the background is Aaron, which is red in this particular spinner. So it happened to land on Aaron again. The background was already red. So again, great radio,
the
best radio. Aaron, what time was Michelle Pfeiffer born at?
The funniest joke here would be to go 12:01 a.m., but then Drew would go 12:02 a.m., and we can't have that. I'm gonna go 6 p.m. I'm gonna go a nice dinner time. You know, like evening.
Dinner time birth, eh?
Yeah, of course.
Nice, very classy. And over to Drew. Drew, when do you think Michelle Pfeiffer was born?
If you put a lineup of actresses and said which one is Michelle Pfeiffer, like you, and Catwoman. With a gun to my head, you might as okay. Don't ruin
no,
it.
The other.
Okay,
you might
sorry,
as well count me dead. You might as well count me dead. Like I have no
also,
idea.
Also, Halle Berry was also Catwoman.
Just I know that it. One, but Halle Berry was Catwoman in Catwoman, which is that basketball scene is absolutely insane.
That is.
I can't even remember.
That's the worst basketball I've ever seen.
So
played.
I don't actually know who Michelle Pfeiffer is. I couldn't pick her out of lineup, and I couldn't say a movie until you said. However, I will say that if she was in Dora the Explorer, she might say. Pfeiffer no fifing, or also there's that classic children's tale, Feeder Pfeiffer, Fick to Fail, Fickle Pfeiffers.
I gotta learn to not stomp on your bits. Yeah,
that's okay. That's really all I got because I wish I could think of anything I knew about her. I cannot. So I'll just go right in between and say noon.
All right, 12 noon. Yeah, so we got guesses of 6 p.m., 12 p.m., and 12 a.m. Michelle Pfeiffer was born at 10:11 a.m. Central, which puts Drew at closest, under 2 hours away from my grammar and communicating this is probably piss poor, but that's what I'm getting myself into. Drew gets a point.
Where did this information come from, Cody?
The great question, Harry, the IMDb trivia section for Michelle Pfeiffer, so you know it's canonical. You know it's canonical.
And do they cite anything?
Harry, have you ever been to an IMDb trivia section?
Fair. Yeah, no,
get
you're
a
right.
fucking grip. Of course not. But it's also
in MLA
gospel.
Format.
Yeah, yeah, not that Chicago stylings. You know what's
Come
what.
Come on, man. Don't shit on Chicago.
Oh, shit. Sorry, Aaron,
don't
I forgot.
My mom was a proofreader. I didn't. It's,
the best. It's the best style.
Yeah,
it's the best style.
It's the best style. It's the best style.
It is. The best, I got nothing. The best game show is Wheel of Fortune as we head into number four. That's not true. But Vanna White, she's a beauty pageant person, co-host of Wheel of Fortune. She was a contestant in Miss Georgia USA 1978. My question for you, as of February 28th, 2024, when I put this together, how many episodes of Wheel of Fortune have there been? How many episodes of Wheel of Fortune? And the first person to guess the answer is going to be Harry.
Oh my God. Deconfirmed. The background was red.
Yeah, the background did change. Yeah.
Yep. Myth no busted.
Yep. I'm going to go with 800 episodes, Cody.
800 episodes. Wheel of Fortune. Lock it in. For
you're way below. You're way under.
I off by a decimal, dude. Like, what do you? I mean, that will fuck it. Terry again.
Damn, gotta. No do overs. No, that's. And when I clicked on an ad, fuck this app. Okay, here we go. Spinning it again. I misclicked and it landed on Drew, hence the blue background. But it's gonna land on Drew again. No, it's gonna land on Aaron. It's over to Aaron. It's gonna be Aaron then Drew. That's the order. This is good radio. Aaron, what's your guess?
I'm going to say Wheel of Fortune's what? 40? I'm going to say 1,800 episodes.
1,800 episodes. Says Aaron, 1,800. And over to Drew. Drew is drawing a blank. No, he's not. He's got an answer, and it is...
Yeah, no, I'm not drawing a blank. I just am contemplating if I want to go how far above that I want to go, because I still think that is far under the amount.
You can just go one above. It's okay. It's cool. You're the guest.
No. On principle, I also thought it would be more interesting if they asked how many letters Vanna White has turned over. Like,
oh,
total.
My God.
That
billions.
Would be wild.
Yeah.
Likely. There's more stars in the universe. There's more letters than stars in the universe.
Yeah, totally exactly.
I'm going to say that there are... 2,500 episodes.
All right. 2,500. Thank you for your guesses. According to IMDb, as we've established, great source of information, everything on it is 100% factual. According to the Internet Movie Database, there have been 7,895 episodes of Wheel of Fortune to date.
I knew it.
That's fucking insane, dude.
Yeah. Which is literally a factor off of what Harry said, like one decimal, which is what Aaron said originally.
So I should get a bonus point.
Fine.
No, that's one decimal place. He meant one order of magnitude.
Yeah. It's that's I can that checks out. Stats major.
Stats major. Yeah. You got it.
That's a wide net. I can cast over anything that involves numbers, which is the best thing about my degree.
I can't conceive of making 7,000 episodes of television, I don't think.
No.
Shout outs to Vanna White, I guess.
Well, we're going to up the frequent where you have that meeting, that trial of meeting. We're just going to crank these episodes out.
Yeah. Fair. Yeah. I'd be into that, I guess. I mean, listen, I would rather do that job than my job.
What year was it that she died and came back? Because like she was Vanna the Gray, and then she came back as Vanna White?
I don't know enough about Lord of the Rings to make a joke. That was in the
old
age, Drew.
I was worried that Gandalf went from white to gray, and so I was like, hopefully this joke makes sense.
Yeah. No, yeah, the joke passes.
The joke
Thou
passes.
Thou shalt not pass!
I like the
just
idea
riffing.
Of Gandalf going from white to gray, becoming
Should
a more
we end the
morally
episode,
ambiguous
more
character, you know?
That's a good question, Aaron. I don't have an answer to it. And that is a good question, Drew. The answer is we have one more question. Drew's having the time of his life because he has a commanding lead. 3 points to Harry's 1 to Aaron 0 for our final question.
Still anyone's game.
well, TBD.
This last one's worth 3 points, so it's anyone's game.
That's... How many points did I make this? Well, we'll get there when we get there. For our final question, we would be fools to not shout out someone who doesn't get nearly enough praise on this podcast. And that is Maggie Cheung, who won first runner-up at Miss Hong Kong 1983, Queen of the Trilon, et cetera, et cetera. Jason is not here this episode, but he will still hold a sort of presence because what we're going to do for this question is put a microscope to his Letterboxd ratings of Maggie Cheung's filmography. And to, I don't know, Drew or anybody else listening who has no idea what Letterboxd is, it's like Goodreads, but for movies. We invoke it a lot on this show. Star ratings, Drew, on Letterboxd range from half a star to 5 stars in half star increments. So like the lowest you can go to like give a movie rating is half a star. It goes all the way up to 5 stars. That's what we're working with here. So Jason has seen 8 movies that include Maggie Cheung as a credited actor. My question for you, what is Jason's overall average rating for a Maggie Cheung film? Like it's aggregated, what's the average rating that he gives a Maggie Cheung movie? No special scoring for this. You could look at it and say, oh, Drew has already locked up the win. I look at it and say, well, we're playing for pride and pride is the most important thing of all. So take that. But the first guess for this question, Jason's average Maggie Cheung movie Letterboxd star rating, the first guess is going to come from Aaron Grossman. So Aaron, putting you to the test here. How well do you know Jason's interior life to know what he would score Maggie Cheung films on average? What do you think?
Maybe I'm overthinking it, but I think most of the films he's probably scored for Maggie Cheung, we've recorded on, and thus he has not scored it. And so I think there's probably like 3 data points out of the 8 that have ratings. Maybe I'm completely off. I'm going to say it's high. I'm going to say it's
I will say, before you answer, I will say...
You don't
say
have to answer that, Cody. No, you don't have to provide information.
This is an important... I don't want any fundamental misunderstandings of the mm-hmm. question. When I say 8, those are movies that do all have star ratings.
They do
ratings.
Have ratings, not...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm still gonna go
because I did communicate that poorly. Letterboxd gives you the numbers good, and it's like that's how it labels. So these all have star ratings. I checked.
4.
Plus, it would have
5.
Been such a strategic blunder to say all that information to Gus. Give all that information to our opponents about how many he had seen.
Yeah,
I'm gonna say 4.
Yeah. Sorry, you said your number. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Sorry. All right. 4. 4.0. Sorry, I'm just putting in decimal.
Let's go 4.16.
Okay. Awesome. I'm really glad you went out to the nearest 100th. That's what I was gunning for. 4.16. No, I do appreciate it. All sarcasm aside, you son of a gun. And we're gonna go over to Drew for his guess. So Letterboxd novice over here.
Yeah, I don't use Letterboxd. I'm familiar. Sometimes when I watch a movie and I want to see what other funny people have to say about it, you can look at the popular reviews on Letterboxd. So I've been. Mm. I haven't seen any Maggie Cheung movies, but I know who that is because Harry has recommended at least one to me. That being said, I think Jason probably feels pretty highly about these movies just based on what I know about what Harry thinks of these movies. And therefore, I'm going to go just above what Aaron said and 4.25
for Drew, locking it in. And the final guess of the day, the week, whatever, is going to come from Harry. Harry, what do you think for Jason's Maggie Cheung aggregate rating?
Maybe just to cover the spread a little bit. And also, I feel like there might be a curve breaker we're not thinking about, like Police Story 3, maybe even Police Story 2 that he wasn't like a huge fan of. So I'm going to go with 3.7, Cody.
Gotcha. All right. 3.7 is the guess from Harry, doing some quick double checkings and tabulations. And I think I got us to where we need to be. I'll get ahead of it first and say thank you. This has been Miss Trilove 2024. I will bestow the crown upon the winner, which again, nothing we did here changed that. The winner is Drew, but again, pride is on the line here. And so I'll just say Jason's Maggie Cheung aggregated star rating is 3.9. So Harry was closest by a couple decimal points here. Drew came in with 3 points.
Cute.
Yeah, a little too. Well, I mean, it's a beauty pageant, so what are you going to do? So Aaron with the donut, Harry with 2 points. So first runner up, I guess. And then Aaron is second runner up, or however they do it.
That means Aaron got second.
Da, 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 da. Yeah.
Yeah. Second runner up. I got second place.
No, it means you got third. Aaron's gruff partner says just off screen. For fun, I decided to compare this to others on this panel who do use Letterboxd. And so these totals are, as Aaron cited up front, these are swayed by Letterboxd entries where the movie is logged, but there's no star rating for those who, you know, we do it for the podcast or whatever, and then we don't go back and put in star ratings. So like Aaron just literally has 3 data points, but Aaron's aggregate Maggie Chung movie rating is 3.5, 3.5 on the dot. Harry has 9 data points to go off of movies that were ranked on Letterboxd. 4.1 for Harry, good form. And my data set is 26 Maggie Chung films, and the wider slate there, I got brought back, mine is brought back down to 3.8, just because there are some stinkers in the mix, but ultimately, in conclusion, Maggie Chung. And so the pop-off platform, Drew, is now yours, where you take, you know, a moment or a minute or anything that you want to say, just in accordance with your victory. If you want to shout out anybody, you know, it's sort of an acceptance speech. Nobody's going to play you off, or if you want to like punch down at your opponents, sometimes the rest of these fellas do something like that. But if there's anything you want to say following up your heroic Miss Trial of 2024 victory, the space is yours to do so.
Sure, yeah. Breaks crown in half. And this piece is for Harry Mackin, a partial victor in the 2024 whatever trial of woman of the girl. And this partial winner crown piece goes to Aaron for also being a partial victor, because we're all winners today. Thank you, everybody. Shout out to that scene from Mean Girls.
Did you see the musical, Drew, by the way?
I saw the musical on Broadway back with the original cast.
Okay, that sounds cool.
Taylor Lautermann was playing Regina, but I have not seen the musical.
Okay.
I didn't really love it. Maybe I should have seen the Broadway version. But
the Broadway version is also fine.
Yeah.
But at least that one has the virtue of being a completely different medium.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know what else is a different medium? Podcasting. And this episode is about to run its course. I do want to, I mean, we just did a whole bunch of it, but I mean, Drew owned that last segment, and he's been shining star today. Drew, want to thank you again for being on the episode today to talk about Minnesota's Drop Dead Gorgeous. Any sort of plugs, like socials wise, or I don't know, anything else you want to I know you just did a beautiful thing with the crown, but if there's anything else you want to kind of debrief your appearance with.
I thought it was
serious, but yeah, for sure.
Yeah, no one really understands the tone of my voice or anyone's voice, so that was all a joke, just so you know. Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun to talk about this film, and the fact that you know, we all have the Minnesota angle is really something special that no other podcast can top. Try to top it. Tag us in the comments. You can find me on the internet doing some stuff if you want. You can search for my name. You'll probably find me that way. I do a lot of different stuff. If you're in Minneapolis, this month and next month, at Huge Wednesdays at Huge Theater in Uptown Minneapolis, I'll be doing an improv duo set where we do a replay of a scene where one person starts a scene as if the other person is there, and then they replay that scene without changing it, and the other person inserts themselves and tries to make it make sense. It's a really funny show called Too Naive at Huge Wednesdays. That's Wednesdays in Minneapolis. Don't know when this will go out, but March and April, so should be maybe some time for people to hear this and then go to that show. That's you can find me. You can find me at Brittany Howard on Twitter. And yeah, it was just a pleasure to be on.
Hell yeah. Thanks so much. Yeah, we'll get some stuff thrown in the show notes. Yeah, this will drop in a very timely fashion, so we'll make sure folks are hip to those details. Thank you a bunch for that. Shout out to Brittany Howard as well. And thank you to our dear listeners for tuning in this week. You can find us on Twitter at Trial of Podcast. You can find the Trial On at trialon.org. Support them. They're really great. Why don't you go see a movie there for a change? How about that? Think about that. And think about Jason Daphnis, who, again, cannot be here this week. You can find him on most/all socials at Nintendoofus. I've been Cody Narveson. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narveson and Twitter at Cody_BH.
Yeah, thanks so much, Drew. Go see Drew's improv. He's hilarious, and those shows are always super fun. Drew also does mashups of songs that are really, really good. He does a bunch of games. He does a bunch of stuff. You should check all of it out. It's all great. You can find me on Twitter at PunishTake.
My name is Aaron. You can find me on Twitter at RVPlease.
You guys want some shots? I'm buying.
Make it all seem worthwhile. When it's too early, you should know it. With these plans and every mental movement, you show it.